explanation of the momentum space Feynman rules. So I'd just like to finish that up today before we move on to converting these amplitudes that we spent all of last week learning how to calculate into physically measurable quantities such as cross sections and decay rates. And so that'll be the rest of today's lecture. So just a reminder of what we did last time. So last time we were applying the LSC formula, which I've written out again on the board here, to convert our Green's functions into scattering amplitudes. And we were in the process of developing a set of Feynman rules that would let us directly write down these things without going through all the steps that we learned how to do last week. One result that I stated without any sort of argument at all last time was that we should amputate our diagrams. And so I'd like to begin by discussing why we need to amputate. And to do that, I'm just going to start by means of an example. So let's look at one of these diagrams that I said we should throw away. And let's figure out why. So let's look at this diagram here. So this is similar to the diagram we looked at last time, except it has this extra loop here. And so if we want to write down, use the Feynman rules, position space Feynman rules, to write down the Green's function for this diagram, we can do that. So first of all, we have two vertices. So we get two factors of minus I lambda. Secondly, we have also from the two vertices, we have integrals over those vertices. So d4y and d4z. Then we also have six different propagators. So from 1 prime to y, from 1 to y, from 1 prime to y, from 2 prime to y, from 2 to z, from z to z, and from y to z. And then we also have a symmetry factor because this propagator from z to z, we can switch the ends without changing the diagram. So we can switch the two ends of this loop and propagator in the loop, and so we get a factor of 2 here. Okay, so we can then plug this into the LSC formula to figure out what the contribution to the scattering amplitude from this diagram is. And so to do that, so this is the contribution from this diagram, I'll indicate like that. And what we get, these integrals stick around. And using the same thing we did last time for the propagators that go to the external points, because delta, say 1y, is a Green's function. So when we act with the Klein-Gordon operator, d squared 1 plus m1 squared, we just get a delta function, and then we can use that to do the x1 integral. So I'll just skip all those steps because that works the same way that we saw last time. And what we end up with is, so once we do that for those four propagators to external points, we get e to the I p1 minus p1 prime minus P2 prime all times y. And then e to the I P2 z. So after we integrate over the delta function, we just will set the x1, x2, or x1 prime or x2 prime equal to y. So these are the factors that come from the acting with the Klein-Gordon operator on the propagator, then integrating over the resulting delta function. And then we're left with the two propagators from internal points, delta zz, delta yz. So we know that we can write a propagator from y to z. In terms of the integral over k, I over k squared minus m squared plus I epsilon, e to the I k y minus z. So this is just the formula for the Feynman propagator we derived at the beginning of last week. And if we plug this in here, what we get is an integral over k integral over q. So we can do the same thing for delta zz. And we get these factors of k squared minus m squared plus I epsilon from delta yz, and the same thing with q for delta zz. Then we can do the y and z integrals because the only place that y and z appear after we plug this in here is in the exponentials. So we'll just get a delta function. So for y, we will have a delta function of p1 minus p1 prime minus p2 prime plus k. And the delta zz doesn't contribute any exponential because it's a propagator from z to z, so the exponential is just 1. So what we get after we do the y integral is 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 p1 plus k minus p1 prime minus p2 prime. And similarly for z, so this factor comes from the y integral. And we also get the same thing from the z integral p2 minus k on the z integral. Okay. So this suggests the origin of one of the Feynman rules we wrote over here. So number 4 was momentum conservation at each vertex. So if we wanted to directly write down the Feynman rules for this diagram, we have a delta function here that tells us that momentum is conserved here if we have momentum, say p1 going in p2, p1 prime, sorry, the same way, p2 prime, p1 prime, and some other momentum here, k. So this tells us to conserve momentum at this vertex. And this tells us to conserve momentum at this other vertex. Now, this expression I've written down here is problematic. And to see that, let's use the second delta function to do the k-integral. Okay. So we have a term that looks like d4k delta 4 of p2 minus k 1 over k squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And that's just equal to 1 over p2 squared minus m squared, which is equal to 1 over 0. Because all of our particles have mass m. This q, so I could write down the same thing for delta zz. So delta zz, I'm writing as integral d4q over 2 pi to the 4th, 1 over q squared minus m squared plus I epsilon e to the 0.
And can you please explain the figure there from the expressions?
So what we're trying to do, so this is our result for the momentum space Feynman rules. So we'd like to go directly from a diagram like this to an analytic expression. So that's our ultimate goal. And I gave you the result last time. So this is how we can take this diagram and try to go directly to a contribution to the scattering amplitude.
You don't have any
P2
in the
diagram. Oh, this should be 2. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so this seems like a problem. So how do we resolve this? Well, I gave you the answer last time. The answer is we need to disregard these diagrams, but why? So let's think physically about the assumptions we made when we derived the LSE formula.
So, I mean, apart from that, there's another infinity from the Q integral as well, right?
That's right.
Yeah. In this diagram.
Yes. So this diagram is, this is not the only reason this diverges. In any case, we should disregard this diagram. And that's because in the LSE formula, we assumed that our initial and final states were eigenstates of the exact Hamiltonian. So so the basic reason why we should throw this away is because the single particle states of the free theory are not the same as the single particle states of the interacting theory. And so a one particle state of the interacting theory can be written as the one particle state. So this here is the one particle state in the free theory. Plus corrections that are exactly of the form we just saw. So for instance, there's a correction that just have a loop on this propagator. You know, several loops or a more, in a variety of different ways. So these In the LSE formula, we assumed that we were starting and ending with the one particle or n particle states of the interacting theory. That's not what we're doing if we include these non-amputated diagrams. So if we want to all of these corrections to the external legs basically just account for the difference between our states in the interacting theory and the interact and the free theory.
Sorry, you said that in LSE formula we assume that our in and out states are states of the free theory.
Of the interacting theory.
It's the asymptotic states.
That's right. So all of these just account for the difference between the one particle states in the free theory and the one particle states of the interacting theory, which is what we want to use.
So haven't you just shown that the one particle states in the interacting theory can't be normalized?
So this diagram is divergent. We'll talk about how to cure these divergences tomorrow. So we'll talk some. I'll give you a partial answer at least tomorrow, but we'll come back to that.
So I don't remember. I was hoping you could just remind me quickly in the previous board where the I epsilons came from and also where it went when you did the integral over the direct delta.
OK. So these I epsilons came from the Feynman. So we wrote down the Feynman propagator. Remember, there were several different Green's functions. And the reason we chose this prescription was related to the fact that we're time ordering everything. So because the LSE prescription tells us to time order, and the Green's function that obeys the correct boundary conditions if we're time ordering everything has this I epsilon. And so that, remember, this was just a mnemonic for the complex contour in which we should do the zero component of the integral. So there are two poles, and we need to decide which way to go around the poles. And the I epsilon tells us just to go below one and above the other. Okay, so that brings us then to our momentum space Feynman rules for the scattering amplitudes. So we can directly compute the matrix elements by summing all completely connected. Remember, we threw out the ones that were not completely connected because we're only interested in scattering. The ones that were not completely connected just corresponded to trivial processes where there's no interactions. So this was just because we're physically interested in the cases where there is scattering. We need to amputate to correctly account for the initial and final states, being initial and final states of the interacting theory instead of the free theory. And then we get these internal propagators. This basically just came from when we wrote the position space propagators. We had this factor of I over k squared minus m squared plus I epsilon, which went away because we had the Klein-Gordon operators acting on the external points. So that killed the ones that were on external points, but the internal ones survived. This vertex is the same as it was when we were the same Feynman rule as we had when we were looking at the Feynman rules for the Green's functions. This one is just to remind you when we get to fermions and gauge bosons that you need to do something for the external lines. But there's no factor in the scalar case. It's momentum conservation at each vertex. I explained, so that's the delta function that comes from doing the integrals over the position. Divide by the symmetry factor, that's the same as before. And then we need to integrate over any undetermined momentum. So if we have loops, it's possible that we have more integrals than vertices at which to impose momentum conservation. Yes?
Sorry, I missed the connection between what you wrote in the bottom board there and why we should
anticipate. So our assumption in the LSE formula was that our initial and final states were states of the interacting theory, which are not the same as the states of the free theory. And these diagrams here account for the difference. So remember, delta is the propagator of the free theory. So it takes a particle in the free theory and propagates it. But it's not exactly the propagator of the interacting theory. So if we treat, we're doing perturbation theory, and we add some small terms to our Lagrangian, then it will be approximately the correct propagator, but there'll be corrections that will. So all of the quantities in the free theory will receive corrections that we can systematically incorporate order by order in the coupling constant of the theory.
So what exactly is that formula saying? Because the diagram is supposed to correspond to
so it's
contribution to the scattering amplitude.
Right. So it's
So
it's saying that if we're looking at 2-to-2 scattering in 5-4 theory, so this is the leading order contribution. At the next order, we would think there would be contributions like this, plus we could have corrections on other legs, a bunch of other terms. What this is saying is that we should amputate this and not count this as a separate diagram. So after we amputate, this diagram is the same as this. And the reason for that is because we want our initial states not to just be the, so here we have two particles coming in, but they're propagating from negative infinity to the point at which they interact with the free propagator if we say that the propagation is just given by this line instead of this plus corrections on the lines. So all of these terms like this just give corrections basically to what we think is what's the initial state. So it's not the initial state is not just the two-particle state in the free theory, it's a two-particle state in the interacting theory.
At which
yes.
point did we, like, it's, we started off with this FI, and we went from there through LSF to this,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, to a like, time-ordered expectation value. And then we turned that into, like, a numerator divided by the denominator, where, like, the numerator contains all possible diagrams and numerator.
Mm-hmm.
And then we evaluated those by Wick's rules. At which point did we make the assumption, at which point does this assumption that we can, like, do amputations come in?
So it really came in when we were talking about imposing that the one particle state was orthogonal to the interacting vacuum. So this was zero, and we imposed that the form factor took the same form as it did in the free theory. So that's the point in our discussion in which it came in. And
what was the question? I couldn't hear you.
So where did the fact that we were using initial and final states that were exact states of the interacting theory enter into our discussion of LSC. So it's when we impose these kind of conditions. Yes.
So we can write the time-ordered expectation value of interacting vacuum of that thing up there in terms of the non-interacting vacuum or whatever, right?
Right.
So the things that we're trying to calculate are all for just the vacuum state, ultimately. I mean, we want to get that expression, but we have a relation. So the only states we want are the vacuum ones. Is that why we're amputating? We're looking at amputated states?
So well, yeah. So the reason we can do that is because we want to basically we want to think of this as a one particle state. So that's related. So if we can think of this as a one particle state, then we can construct n particle states just by acting with phi on the vacuum multiple times. Yes.
Is it right to say then that we're effectively dealing with a phi bar, like an effective field that consists of phi plus all back pulleys on the additional correction? Or is that not the right way to think about it?
The interacting field is not the same as the free field, so there's some way in which you can think of one as being, as the interacting field as being a sum of various terms involved in the free field. Okay.
So, which of these rules change depending on the interaction?
Number two, the vertex changes depending on the, assuming we're restricting ourselves to scalar field theories, then only number two changes. When we include higher spin fields, as we will later, number one will change, number three will change as well. But four through six are completely general.
And there are a few extra rules.
Yes. There are additional rules as well, but those three don't change. Okay. So let's move forward to cross sections and decay rates. So we know how to compute scattering amplitudes now, but we can't directly measure a scattering amplitude. What we can measure are things like cross sections and decay rates. And so we need a way to convert scattering amplitudes into something we can actually measure. And so let's start out by just discussing classical physics. And we'll see that things work mostly the same. In QFT, with a few differences that I'll point out when we get to it. So let's suppose that we have two beams of particles, say we have particles, we'll call these particles B, that have a density rho B that's constant, and the particles of type B are moving, we'll work in a frame where they're moving to the right with some velocity v. And we'll collide these with some particles of type A that have a density rho A. And for simplicity, let's assume these are point masses. And these are spheres of radius A. Radius R. And so these ones are at rest. And instead of a continuous beam, let's just assume that we There's a small pulse that has a length LB, which is equal to V times some time. And we'll assume that these particles are uniformly distributed along some length LA. And let's denote by A the cross-sectional area common to both beams. So, classically, the number of collisions between the particles of type A and the particles of type B, we can write down just in terms of the quantities I've written here. So the number of collisions should be equal to the density of the particles of type A times LA. So here, rho is the number density. Not mass density. Times rho B, LB, times the area. And the coefficient relating these is just the cross section here. Which in this case, sigma is just pi r squared, the cross section of these spheres. So the number of collisions should be proportional to both of the densities. If we increase the densities, we'll increase the number of collisions. The length of each beam, cross sectional area, and the cross section of the particle.
Why is it A not A squared? It's like LA, A. LAA and LBA.
So this is a length.
Yeah.
So this is a number density times an area times a length is a number. This is a number density times a volume, which is also a number.
So right, what's the logic of where did you pull that from?
We can think about a single particle of B. So the probability that that particle of type B will hit one of the particles of type A should be proportional to sort of the area that it can hit a particle of type A divided by the total area. And so that would so the area in which it could hit something of A would be proportional to rho B LA times the cross section. And then this other factor is just the number of particles.
Thanks.
That'd be.
Question?
Yes.
Sorry, I'm not clear on the difference between sigma and A.
Okay, so let's look at the look head on. So at this, we'll look from this direction at the particles of A. So the particles are spheres. So this is one particle of A. So this is a particle A. This is one particle. This is another particle. And the size of each of these particles, each A particle, has cross section. Sigma. And this total area, A is the area in which there are A particles. So A is bigger than sigma.
Okay.
del A in that picture is what?
In this picture?
Yeah.
So we're looking at it head on. So LA would be measuring the how far it extends into the board. If I could draw it at an angle, the particles would only extend in some volume, and this would be LA. So, can write this in another way. So I kind of explained in words, but we can also write this. The number of collisions as sigma times the number of particles of A times the number of particles of B over A. So here this is NB. It's the number of particles of type B. So it's rho B LB times A. And similarly for NA. You can also write this then as sigma NA NB times BT over volume. So volume, the volume is the volume in which the collisions occur. So this volume here is, say, L, LB times A. Okay. And the reason we can do this is then we can find the probability of collisions which is the number of collisions divided by the number of particles of type A times the number of particles of type B. So it's the probability that a given particle of type A will collide with a given particle of type B. And then we can write this in terms of the cross section, the velocity of the particles of type B, the time over which the collision occurs, and the volume in which the collisions occur. Okay. So we're going to use this formula. So this formula is quite general. It doesn't really depend on any of the details of the collision process we occurred. And so we're going to take this formula to define what we mean by a cross-section in QFT. Okay. So what we've been computing before are scattering amplitudes, and if we square those, we can find probabilities. So then we can convert that to a cross section using this formula. Okay. So let's go to QFT now. And for simplicity, I'll assume that we start with two particles. So let's go consider 2 to n scattering. And so that means that our initial state is k1, k2. And our final state is called p1 up through pn. And so the probability of going from this initial state to this final state should be infinitesimal because there are continuous parameters here. We could have, if we want to get a finite probability, we should integrate over some range of, say, the final momentum. So the differential probability should be equal to the amplitude to go from I to F squared divided by, because we chose a normalization, we chose the Lorentz invariant normalization, so our initial and final states are not unit normalized, so we need to divide by the norm of I and the norm of F. And if we want to get a finite probability, we need to integrate over the final momentum. So the infinitesimal quantities over here should be the momenta of the final particles. So it's a product from j equals 1 to n of d3 bj. And then there's these extra factors here that I'll try to motivate in a minute. So a factor of the volume and 2 pi cubed. And so where does this come from? So a way to think about where this comes from is imagine making space periodic so that the so we can motivate this from making space periodic with a volume of L cubed. And if we do that, then the momenta are quantized. And so where these are integers, I have integer components. And then if we wanted to get a finite probability in this theory with a periodic space, what we would do is we'd sum over the n's, and that sum would become an integral e3 p j times the volume over 2 pi cubed if we took the limit that L goes to infinity. So we did something similar in the second lecture, I think. So I won't go through all the details, but we have these extra factor of volume and 2 pi cubed, just to the correct normalization here. Yes?
Why is it the product?
Well, so imagine you're scattering 2 particles into, say, 3 particles. If we just integrate over one of the final momenta, we probably still have an infinitesimal probability because if we exactly specify the other 2 momenta, right? So we need to integrate over some finite region of all of the final momenta in order to get something non-zero in general. That's why you'd expect that there are several integrals to do over here. Does that answer your question? So we can compute f inner product of f and I. So we can compute this amplitude using the LSZ formula. We argued that the form that this takes, fi, it always has this delta function. We pulled that out and defined this amplitude to be equal to 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 times the sum from j equals 1 to n of pj minus k1 minus k2. This is just the overall momentum conserving delta function that was common to all scattering amplitudes. So we have this thing squared, because we're taking the norm squared, then times the norm of the matrix element squared. So this is delta squared. So that seems like a problem. It's in general not well defined. But the origin of this second delta function basically has the same origin as we can interpret it as being the overall volume of space, just like we did last week when we looked at the vacuum energy. So we can write this quantity in brackets squared as, we'll keep one of the momentum conserving delta functions. And write the other one as delta of 0. And so we interpreted this before as just the integral of e to the I times 0 times x, which was just the volume of space. Before it was the volume of space. Now this is because it was a three-dimensional delta of 0. Now it's the volume of space time. So it's just the volume times t. So I'm not going through the full argument like we did before, but it's the same basic idea. Okay. And we also have factors of the volume of space in the norm of I and the norm of F. They have the same origin. That's because we chose the Lorentz invariance normalization. And so remember, our one-particle states were normalized so that we have kk is 2 pi cubed 2ek delta 3 of 0, which is just 2 ek times the volume. Yes? The delta function squared. So we write it as a delta function and times a delta function of 0. And we argued that we can interpret a delta of 0 as being the limit as. So what we did was we computed the volume of space in a periodic space and took the limit as L goes to infinity. And we did that by writing the volume of space as in terms of its Fourier transform.
How can you write the delta squared as the product of this delta function?
Oh, and another delta function. So it was delta squared. So I can use, so if we have delta of x, x times some function of x, I'm just writing this as delta of x times f of 0. So that's how I wrote the delta squared as a delta of 0. Okay, so we have this factor of volume in the initial and final states. It just comes from this normalization. So we have that II is 2EK1 2 EK2 times two factors of the volume. And similarly, F has n factors of the volume. And we can combine these results to get a formula for dp. And we can write this as dp equals d phi, which I'll write in a minute. This is what's known as the phase space. Phase space measure. We have this, the matrix element squared over 2 EK1, 2 EK2, times T over the volume. And the phase space is 2 pi to the fourth. So we'll just put all the extra factors that I didn't write over there. Here, we have this one delta function and then the measure of the momentum. And most of the volume factors have canceled out. We had originally over there, over here, n factors of the volume. Those canceled with the n factors of the volume we had here. We had two here and one other one in the numerator. So we're just left with one factor of the volume there.
Sorry, Dan.
Yes.
If you look on the left-hand side, you've got KK, II, and FI. Should the last one be?
Oh, this should be FF. Thank you. Okay. So we're almost there. So we can relate this differential probability to our differential cross-section using the result we had before. So we'll take this as the defining relation between the probability of collision and the cross-section. So doing that, we get that differential cross-section is the phase space times the matrix element squared divided by 2 EK1, 2 EK2, times B. And the factors of T and the volume cancel out. So this is our final result. And so So this is valid in the frame where B is stationary, or A is stationary, and B has velocity v. There are two ways to generalize this beyond that. So one is what's known as the Lorentz invariant cross section. Some authors use the Lorentz invariant definition. Other authors, such as Peskin, use the define a cross section that transforms how you'd think a cross-section transforms. The two definitions agree as long as your collisions are collinear. So they're head-on collisions. So the difference won't really matter in practical cases. But if we want this to be Lorentz invariant, our phase space measure is already Lorentz invariant. So this delta function is Lorentz invariant. This is just our Lorentz invariant measure. The matrix element is Lorentz invariant. So we need this thing to be Lorentz invariant to define the Lorentz invariant cross-section. And the unique way to do that if we want it to agree with our result in this particular frame is that we need V to be root P1, P2 squared minus M1 squared, M2 squared over EK1, EK2 in a general frame. So with this, then sigma is Lorentz invariant. Yeah, so again, there's two definitions, but they agree in the cases that in which you'll use them in practice.
The cooling recursion, is that a Lorentz invariant statement, or can we, does it, I guess it's a collinear
difference. So the statement, so the non-Lorentz invariant cross-section is still invariant under a subgroup of the Lorentz transformations.
Oh.
So a subgroup of the Lorentz transformations along boosts along the direction of the collision.
But once I express V in that form, then it's Lorentz invariant.
Then it's Lorentz invariant in any frame. Yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is that if in some frame it's collinear, would it be collinear in all frames or no?
No, it wouldn't. Okay, so that's the decay cross section. So the other case we'll be interested in is a decay rate. Unfortunately, not a lot changes, so we don't have to go through much of the derivation again. So first of all, there are two different things we can mean by gamma. So there's the total decay rate, which is defined to be 1 over the lifetime of the particle. But unstable particles sometimes have multiple decay channels. So in that case, the total decay rate is equal to the sum over the possible decay channels of the partial decay widths. So this is what's known as a decay width. This is the total decay rate. Okay. And so as for the cross section, we specified the final state. So it's easier to write down a formula for the partial decay width, where we're specifying what the particle is decaying to. And in that case, very little changes. So the differential partial decay rate, k width, should just be the probability to k per unit time. So the probability, differential probability will take the same form, except we only have one initial particle. So we can use our results from before. The only thing that will change is that we have one initial particle. So instead of 2 EK1, 2 EK2, we'll just have 2 EK1. And one of the factors of the volume came from the normalization of our initial state. So up to those changes, it's the same as we had before. And so we can just use our same formula. And if we want this to be Lorentz invariant, then we should just take this to be evaluated in the center of mass frame. In which case, this is just so this is our formula for the partial decay width. There's one subtlety here, though. So our derivation of the LSE formula assumed that we had asymptotic states. Right? So if we're looking at the decay of an unstable particle, we're not really justified in using what we learned about the LSE formula to calculate these matrix elements. It turns out you can justify it, not the way that I did, but the results are unchanged. But just be aware that is a subtlety, and what I've told you does not really justify computing this in the same way that we have for stable particles that can be used for asymptotic initial or final states. Okay. Yes?
Is there a way to interpret the cross-section with decay rates? Because decay rates are related to probability, which is related to cross-sections. Or is that interpretation just because it's one particle decay? And so is there a way to interpret that?
Interpret it as a cross-section. So. This formula was valid when we were colliding two particles. We were asking what's the cross section for the particle of type A to collide with the particle of type B.
But we still use that probability. We related.
So we calculate. We're still using this formula. This formula, which was the QFT probability with we're using this formula exactly. The only change came in because for the cross section, we were assuming we started with two particles, and we computed II in the case where we started with two particles. For the decay rate, we're starting with one particle, so that factor changed.
So the fact that we can use something very close for the decay to
mm-hmm.
the cross section, is that related to cross
symmetry somehow? So there's I'll come back to that at the end of the lecture if I have time. No.
What was the question?
The question was about crossing symmetry, which I hope to get to today. Okay. Okay, so that's the differential decay rate and the differential cross section. So in order to compute the total cross section or total decay width, we would need to integrate over these differential quantities that we wrote down. And so one thing to keep in mind is that if we're going from these differential equations, differential expressions for the partial decay width or the cross-section, we should only integrate over inequivalent final states. So sometimes we have distinct particles in our final states, and that's not a problem. But we're often interested in the case where we have identical particles in our final state. And so if we want finite quantities, the partial decay width or cross section, we should integrate over inequivalent final states. So there are two ways to do that. One, we could restrict the range of integration. In practice, that's very difficult, or usually not necessarily very difficult, but at least more difficult than the other alternative. So in practice, the easier way to do it is to just divide by a symmetry factor. So for instance, if you have two identical scalars in your final state, you can integrate over all P1 and P2, or P1 and P2 are the final momenta, then just divide by two, because you could labeling the momentum of the two identical bosons is your double counting.
So do you mean integrate over equivalent final state?
What you want to do is integrate over the inequivalent. If you integrate over all, then you're integrating over several copies of the equivalent states, and you need to divide by a symmetry factor. Okay. So that's the general concept, and so I thought for the remainder of class, or next 20 minutes at least, we can look at an example of how this works in practice. So we'll consider this theory that I'll call the scalar nucleon meson theory. And it's a toy model for the interaction of nucleons with mesons, but we're treating everything just as a spin zero particle. I believe Tibor might come back to this theory and see what changes when you include the spins of the nucleons. And so we'll take our Lagrangian just to be one complex scalar, which I'll call rho, which will be the nucleon. So this is the nucleon, complex. Then also a real scalar, which will be the meson. And so the mass of the nucleon will be big M. The mass of the meson will be small m. And assume that they interact with one interaction term that's coupling G that couples a nucleon, an antinucleon, and a meson together. And do perturbation theory assuming that G is much less than the masses. So G here has dimensions of mass. So this theory respects the U1 symmetry. where rho goes to E to the I theta rho, and phi goes to phi. So there's a conserved charge. So this is just the same. So we studied this theory without the meson, and the meson is just basically a spectator. We do this U1, has the same U1 symmetry as the complex scalar field that we looked at last week. Okay, so let's look at the Feynman rules for this theory. So we know what the propagators are, but let's just give ourselves a way to distinguish propagators that involve nucleons with mesons from propagators that involve mesons. So let's draw the nucleon propagator with a solid line. And so the nucleons are charged, so I'll indicate the flow of charge with an arrow on the propagator and the flow of a momentum by an arrow beneath the propagator. And so this is just I over k squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And we'll denote, so this is for the nucleon. And for the meson, we'll draw it with the dashed line. And the mesons don't have charge, so there's no arrow on the propagator. You can indicate the flow of momentum with an arrow beneath the propagator. And just the familiar propagator. And there's one vertex. So we need a Feynman rule for the vertex. So the vertex has a meson and a nucleon, an antinucleon, if they're all flowing in. And so the Feynman rule for this vertex is just minus IG. So to illustrate how to compute a cross-section, let's look at a simple example. The cross-section for a nucleon, two nucleons to scatter into two nucleons. So let's look at rho-rho to rho-rho scattering. So the first thing we need to do to compute this cross-section is we need to figure out the matrix element. So the formula for the cross-section. So we'll first compute M. And then we'll turn to the phase space. So at leading order, there are two diagrams that contribute to this scattering. So I'll have time going upwards. There's this diagram and the crossed diagram. And let me label the momenta. So let's assume our initial momenta are k1 and k2. This way, we have P1 and P2 going out. And same thing over here. And then we have some momentum, the momentum of the meson, which by momentum conservation is, we had to draw it going this way, is K1. Minus P1 in this case. And over here, it's K1 minus P2. So these are the only two order G squared diagrams we can draw. there's a whole bunch more at order g to the fourth. So we can then use our Feynman rules to write down the matrix element for this. So our matrix element is, we have two vertices. So we have a minus ig squared. And then we just have one internal propagator in this left diagram. And it's just the momentum flowing along the line is k1 minus p1. And the other diagram is the same, except we have different momentum for the meson. And that's it. So that's our matrix element. OK, so that wasn't too bad. Let's turn to the phase space next. Yes? So the third diagram you're thinking of, probably the flow of charge doesn't work. So we always, our vertex always has one arrow going in to the vertex and one arrow going out of the vertex.
So this is what you mean by in the equivalent Feynman space, right? That P1 and P2 have crossed.
That's right, yeah. Okay. So let's turn to the phase space. So d phi, which I'll denote here in this case as d phi 2, because there are two particles in our final state, is equal to 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 p1 plus p2 minus k1 minus k2, which is the momentum conserving delta function, and we have integral d3 p1 over 2 pi cubed 2e p1. And the same thing for p2. OK. So this is Lorentz invariant. So we can evaluate it in any frame we like. So let's work in the CM frame. The center of mass frame. So that means that k1 is equal to minus k2. And the zeroth component of k1 and k2 are the same. And let's just give their common value a name, E. I'm going to simplify things a bit more. So I'm going to work in the relativistic limit. So I'll assume that E is much greater than M and M. And you'll work out the general case in tutorial tomorrow. So if we make that approximation, let's start to simplify this. Can you repeat that?
Do you need to multiply by M or something?
By M. So I'm not writing the cross section, I'm just writing the phase space.
All right. Didn't our derivation assume that one of the particles was at rest? But now we're going to the center of a mass frame, which that's not true.
So our original derivation did. We're going to take the definition of V to be that invariant quantity right there. So we're going to work with the invariant cross section. So we can use this delta function to do, say, the P2 integral. So if we do that, d phi 2 is equal to, well, first of all, most of these factors of 2 pi cancel out. We're left with 2 pi squared. We have the 2 ep1, 2 ep2. We can use the spatial part of this delta function to do the p2 integral. And we're just left with the zeroth component of this delta function. And this is all evaluated where p1 equals minus p2. And then we can, so ep1 is equal to e of minus p1. So all of these energies are just the same thing. And we can use this, we can go to first spherical coordinates. So let's do that. So what we have is 1 over 16 pi squared. And in the relativistic limit, E P1 is equal to P1, the norm of P1. So this just becomes the two, the EP1, EP2 becomes P1 squared. We go to spherical coordinates, our D3P becomes d omega P1 squared dP1. And then we still have this delta function. Comes 2p1 minus 2e. And we can use this delta function to do the integral over the magnitude of p1. And so what we get and these factors cancel out. So what we get when we do that, just integrate using the other delta function. Is our final expression toward the phase space in the relativistic limit, or the two-body phase space. Okay, so just use the delta function to do the integral. We get d phi 2 is equal to d omega over 32 pi squared. That's because we have a delta of 2p1, so we get a factor of a half. Okay, so this is our expression. And then we can combine this with our matrix element to find the differential cross section. So we can compute d sigma d omega. And this is equal to, just using our results from before, g4 over 256 pi squared e squared times 1 over k1 minus p1 squared minus m squared plus 1 over k1 minus p2 squared minus m squared, all squared. And so this is all Lorentz invariant, so we can evaluate it in the center of mass frame.
How did this become 256?
See, we have a 32 here.
Yeah.
And there was a 4. There was, so d sigma was d phi over d phi m squared over 4 root p1 dot p2 squared minus m1 squared m2 squared. So there's an extra 4.
Okay, the other thing is, when we're doing all these integrals in the phase space, I mean, there was this factor of m squared, you know, tying along with that. So the p's in those would kind of change as well, right?
Yeah, so these should all be evaluated where with all the delta functions we have. So here, p1 equals minus p2. There's a lot of constraints. All the constraints we use up there should be applied to this matrix element as well. I'll just write this as constraints from delta. Take another 2 minutes and complete this cross section, and after that. So we can evaluate, we just need to evaluate the matrix element, and we can do that in the center of mass frame. That's where we applied all our constraints for the d phi. So that's where it will be easiest to evaluate that matrix element squared. So in the center mass frame, you can write k1 as e and k. Because we're in the center mass frame, k2 has to be e minus k. And similarly, P1 has to be EP, and P2 has to be E minus P. And we can evaluate the four vector products of K1 with P1 and K1 with itself, etc. We introduce one other variable. So the only other thing we need to know is, so here we have k, the two particles coming in. And after the collision, they go out with momentum p. So we need to specify this angle, theta. And if we do that, we can work out all of the dot products. So for instance, k1 squared, k2 squared, p1 squared, and p2 squared are all 0. Since we're working the relativistic limit, k1 dot p1 is e squared minus p dot k, which is e squared times 1 minus cosine theta. And if we plug these results in there, we get our final result for the differential cross section, which is g to the fourth for 256 pi squared e squared times cosine squared theta over 1 minus cosine squared theta, all squared. So that's our result. Any questions on that? So in tutorial today, tomorrow, we'll look at it, another example of a cross section. Okay. So that's all I wanted to say today. And tomorrow we'll discuss loops. So I'm just going to say a few things about it. The topic you'll come back to again in QFT2, but we'll get an introduction to loops tomorrow. See you then.